Now calling A230859, CBSM Properties versus County of Hennepin.
All right, and in our, we have a total of four matters, oral matters on our calendar today. The first matter is, as we've just called, and as I indicated, I can see council is here, ready to begin. We're looking forward to hearing from you today. I'll remind you of just a couple of things. You're probably familiar with them. You know our time limits, you know how the podium works, you know about the red lights, things like that. I will ask you before you start your remarks to please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. With that, I think we're ready to proceed, and Council Propellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you.
If I could interrupt for one moment.
I think the microphone.
My microphone is turned off?
I think both of them are muted.
Yeah, they are muted. Mine's muted potentially.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So now is my microphone on?
Yes.
Yes. Excellent.
That is perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Am I on?
Everything else is good.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right, then. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Ryan Somatic, and I represent the appellant in this matter, CBS Minnesota. I'm asking the court to reverse the trial court, reinstate the jury verdict in full, and to remand for proceedings consistent with that relief. Now, I have two main topics that I want to talk about. First, that my client is entitled to the rental value of its property for the time in which its access was undisputedly impaired, and also the cost of restoring that access to make the property functional again. Second point is that reducing that cost, the trial court's reduction of that cost to restore the property to a functional condition, was erroneous. Before getting into those two main topics, however, I want to talk a little bit about some background law on access. Access from property, real property, onto the streets and roads in a reasonably convenient manner is a property right, as the Supreme Court has held multiple times, specifically in Johnson versus City of Plymouth. If I can't access the roads, as it may seem obvious, my property may be worthless or near worthless because I cannot use it for its intended purpose. And that lack of access, it damages not just the frontage of the property, but the entire interior acreage because you just can't use it. And that's the concept that was discussed in the McCurdy case from the New York Court of Appeals that I cited in my brief. When you lack access, it's not just the frontage that's damaged, it's the entire property.
So, counsel, are you telling me that that is a question that we don't have Minnesota law on? Is that why you're turning to New York?
Yes, you're correct. Okay. This situation specifically, where there's been a temporary restriction of access damaging the entire interior, has incurred in our two most populous states, New York and California, and both of them have come back with the same rule that damages are the rental value for the property, the entire property, for the time that access
is lacking. So, counsel, you've shifted a bit there. You're talking now about the measure of damages, where I heard you as describing what the taking was, which, you know, this is a case where the taking decision isn't before us. It's already been decided. There was no appeal taken, and it included a finding of interference in use, possession, enjoyment, et cetera.
Yeah, you're correct, Your Honor. I have gone from what the taking was, a interference with access, to how those damages should be properly measured.
Right. So has Minnesota recognized that an interference with access is a taking?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and I thought so. And what's the case law on that?
I actually haven't researched that case law because that matter, whether the access was a taking, was resolved in the mandamus trial that preceded this damages claim. So that wasn't a focus of this trial court at all, or the appeal for that matter. It's undisputed that a taking of access is a taking under the Minnesota Constitution.
So back to the measure of damages. You're relying on New York law, California law, others. They've been cited in your brief. How do you propose that this court would proceed on that issue? We are not typically the court that would correct the Minnesota Supreme Court on the measure of damages. So what's your argument?
You wouldn't have to correct the Minnesota Supreme Court because they haven't ruled on this particular issue. Now, I think not only do our sister states offer some guidance, but I think this is also just common sense here. if we were proceeding on the basis that access was taken permanently, The measure of damages has been addressed in Minnesota, where you measure the value of the property as if unencumbered by the taking, so the before condition. And then you assume that the property will no longer ever have reasonably suitable access. And the difference between those two represents just compensation. But those just aren't the facts before the court, because although Judge Brassel, who presided over the mandamus trial, found a permanent deprivation of access, 4 years later, the county said, well, we'll give you a permit and you can reconstruct the area that causes this unsuitable access. And by the way, this area that causes this unsuitable access is entirely within county right-of-way, meaning that my client did not previously have a property right or a right at all to just go in there and make the corrections. So if we were proceeding on the traditional before and after, my client's claim would be much larger, because then you're talking about a permanent deprivation of the use of that property. But we're not asking for that. We're only asking for what's fair, the temporary interference with the use of that property caused by the lack of access. And I just want to touch on the fact that the idea that the access is suitable or reasonable, that is not before this court. That was not before the damages court, and that cannot be re-argued because of res judicata. So that ship has sailed. So what I'm asking...
Counsel, if I may interrupt, I'm sorry. I know this is awkward to do from... but, I mean, I appreciate the idea that there was a permit required here. Maybe that makes a difference from some other access cases. Nevertheless, there was a wait of 4 years before there was a permit was sought to make the change. What if you had decided, what's the outer limit on which you could have decided to wait to seek a permit and then let those, what you call then the rental value, continue to accrue and accrue and accrue, and then on top of it, get the cost to cure, even though it's not measured against any before and after, which is the norm.
Yeah, I believe what Your Honor is addressing is a mitigation of damages argument, and my client had no burden to repair areas that were not on my client's own property. So my client had no right to make those repairs. And by the way, because it was entirely within the county's right-of-way, they could have reconstructed the access at any point they wanted to mitigate the damages themselves or to alleviate the taking in the first place. But they never
did. It could have gone up until, I don't know, maybe a statute of limitations or something. Just wait.
Well, there is no statute of limitations on this. Assuming that my client had done nothing, then the trial and damages here would just be a traditional before and after, but again, with the much larger damages figure, because we would be considering a permanent deprivation of access rather than a temporary.
And how do you assume, I mean, you assume that that's much larger, but if we don't have from any of your witnesses, and I know the county had a witness that was to the contrary, we don't have from you a market value with the impaired access and a market value without it. You say it's longer. I mean, it's larger because it's permanent. But how do we know what the market value is with that steeper grade?
Well, because my client's appraiser testified at trial that.
Attention! There has been an emergency reported in the building. Proceed immediately in an orderly manner to the nearest exit and leave the building.
Okay, counsel, we'll resume argument later.
All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Smith, Judge Clary, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's all be seated. Counsel for Appellant, you can remain at the podium if you want. Sorry,
okay.
I didn't mean to imply otherwise. So as the record reflects, we had a brief recess during asked to evacuate the building, and so we did do that. That took about 45 minutes. The marshal has indicated, I think, that the clock has been stopped. Appellant had begun the argument, and the record reflects that and the identities and all of that. So 7:42 is the remaining time on the clock. I think well, first of all, let me verify. Judge Smith, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I almost forgot about that. We'll just resume the argument as it is. And, of course, The judges are aware, counsel are aware. We can certainly extend the argument time if need be, but counsel for appellant has got the 7:42 remaining plus 5 for rebuttal. It'll probably be enough. We'll see. All right, with that, counsel for appellant, you can go right ahead. I'm kind of hoping you remember where you were or what you wanted to say.
I think I was addressing a question from Judge Smith on mitigation. The judge had inquired as to how long my client could wait to seek a permit. Well, first of all, I don't know if I said this or not, but the problem was entirely on kind of county right-of-way. So my appellant had no right to seek this permit as a matter of right, had no right to reconstruct the county's own right-of-way. I've actually never heard of a permit being granted to a private citizen to alter government right-of-way. And the taking, which Judge Brazel found occurred in April of 2017, the trial on whether that was a taking didn't occur until 2018. And during that entire period, the county never said to my client or to the court, hey, by the way, you can just get a permit for this. There is no taking. It's something that they had control of the entire time and never brought up. Regarding the lack of a permit to reconstruct government right-of-way, it's not something that the ordinary citizen would even think is possible. So I don't think my client just sat on their hands for purposes of exacerbating the damages here. All that we're really asking for is a make-whole argument, just to put my client exactly back in the same position they were before the taking occurred. And there are two components to that. There is the time in which my client did not have reasonable access to the property. That's the rental component. And then there's also the cost of restoration to its pre-taking condition to make the property usable again. And only with those two awards is my client put in the same position they were had the government not committed the takings that the mandamus court found. I'd like to use an analogy of a garage. I live in Minneapolis. Let's say the county came down and put some concrete barriers that in my driveway that block my access to the garage, leave them there for a year so I can't use it, and then take them away, in so doing, damaging my driveway. Do I get just the cost of restoring the driveway? No, because I've been deprived of my access to the garage for a year. So the only thing that makes me whole is getting both components.
So explain to me, counsel, it probably seems obvious to you, but help me out, how in that garage, hypothetical, your garage in the city of Minneapolis, where would the rental come in? Is it you renting a garage from a neighbor while your garage is unavailable?
Well, the measure of damages is not what I've had to incur to remedy the situation myself. It's what I've lost. So that would be, what is the reasonable rental value of the garage for the time in which I could not use it? So
it's a loss of use.
Yes, it is a loss of use, Your Honor.
And just to be clear, counsel, could you describe to us what your expert testified to with respect to the loss of use? You had, I think on that property, there was a daycare. Was that no longer in use then during that period of time?
The daycare stayed on the premises, but the damages don't reflect any loss of use to the daycare at all. It was just the development portion of the property, which could no longer be developed for a commercial use because it did not have a suitable commercial access point.
So the rental damages were it developed over that period of time? Can you just describe to me what they are? I'm having trouble picturing. So it's not developed into what the measure of damages is. I don't quite see it yet.
So it's vacant property. Zone commercial, both appraisers testified that commercial was its highest and best use before the taking. And so the rental damages are, what would commercial land rent for on an annual basis? And then you put that over the 55 months in which access was impaired, and you discount that to present value, and that's what the rental damages are, Your Honor.
What vacant land would be?
Yes, correct. Vacant commercial land.
Okay, and not developed then.
Yeah, that's correct. Just vacant land.
Counsel, I have a question on that. There was no evidence offered as to diminution of value, right? Market value before and after?
No, not by my side.
Okay.
And in fact, the county didn't really offer evidence on that either. They said that the driveway, which is perfectly suitable for commercial use, and therefore the damages were zero. And there was already an entire trial on whether there was a diminution of value due to the impaired access in the mandamus side. And the court found in that case that there was. So the damages here have to be something more than zero. Just turning to the remitting of damages here, I believe the court erred there because the damage figure was within the range of evidence. And the court basically found that any damages or any cost of restoration that was outside the actual driveway itself was not recoverable. Now, that is a legal finding right there. But the court didn't, trial court did not send any legal rule that backs that up. And what the legal rule really is when you're restoring your property from a taking, the costs are recoverable if a reasonable person would incur them to put the property back in its pre-taking condition. And because that's an issue of reasonableness, that was for the jury to find whether the costs were reasonable for my client to incur to restore its property. And the jury found that they were, all of them, and awarded the full amount that our expert engineer testified to. So the trial court had no business taking that away from the jury without any legal rule saying that the trial court should do so.
So, counsel, I'd like to go back quickly to this question of damages. We do not have from either side a motion for new trial. Isn't that right?
That is right.
So the propriety of any damage instructions to the jury instructions about damages, isn't in front of this court, right?
Waived, Your Honor, yes.
Yes, by both sides.
Yes.
So was the jury instructed on the measure of damages?
Yeah, the jury was instructed on the measure of damages.
Okay. And that's, of course, a matter of record, what they were instructed. That would be law of the case?
It would be at this point, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And correct me if I'm wrong, just for my memory, the jury was given both measures, right?
Both measures.
Both. In other words, it talked about temporary rental, and it talked about...
I thought both
sides' perspectives were reflected in the jury instructions, and then the special verdict didn't describe more specifically which it should be.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. The trial court didn't want to instruct the jury on one side's theory of damages versus the other, and so it was, as you put it, an even-handed instruction left to the jury to resolve the correct amount of damages.
And so how does that work in terms of, is that a jury question about what measure, isn't that a legal question about what measure should actually apply? It's, you know, to give them both to the jury and then say what amount would fairly compensate and you're not sure which one they chose. Speak to that a little bit.
Sure. I think typically this matter is not disputed because all you're doing is coming up with the value of the property before and after assuming a permanent taking, or in the case of a temporary taking, like an easement, it is just the rental value. And so I think typically it would be a very easy legal question to resolve, but based on the unique facts of the case, I think the trial court was right to turn it over to the jury and see what they thought was the best measure of damages reflected by those facts.
All
right, counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just one quick question. Yeah. With the jury trying to decide the permanent taking before and after, there's no evidence as to diminution of value. How are they going to decide that?
Well, it wasn't a permanent taking, so I don't know if they needed to decide that.
Well, except that wasn't that one of the options they were given? I mean, I think Judge Smith's point is that the district court here gave them two different options, correct?
Sure.
And arguably that was a legal determination that she needed to make before she gave it to the jury, arguably.
Arguably.
Wasn't one of those options permanent? I mean, in other words, diminution of value before and after?
Yeah. I mean, as I was discussing with Judge Smith, it was a kind of an even-handed both sides kind of instruction.
But I mean, I guess my point is, how could they decide before and after when there really wasn't any evidence to that effect?
Well, the county is the one advocating for the strict application of the before and after rule, I guess assuming there's a permanent taking, and so that would have been their burden to put that evidence on the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. So we've reset the clock. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you to begin when you're ready. Feel free to take a few moments and bring your materials up to the podium and make any adjustments to the podium.
May it please the court and counsel. Good morning, my name is Joseph Trojak, and I represent the respondent and cross-appellant in this matter, the County of Hennepin. Your honors, through statute and decades of case law, Minnesota has created a well-established framework for adjudicating what property rights are acquired by public authorities through eminent domain and the measure of just compensation paid to landowners for the property rights acquired. At trial, CBS abandoned this framework and presented evidence to the jury of non-compensable rental damages for an assumed and totally unsupported 83,000 square foot temporary easement that it alleges covered a majority of its property for 55 months. There is no such temporary easement in any petition, order, or jury instruction.
Counsel, would you agree the facts of this case are a little unusual in that they couldn't act in terms of the county right-of-way until they had a permit, and that took some time?
In a sense, yes, because I don't think this situation has come up, at least not in a published case. But there is the Paul case, 95 Northwest 2nd 85, and that case involved a cure that was a variance, and the Minnesota, I think it was Supreme Court, held that that variance was not a cure because it was too speculative, but that cure was not out of hand dismissed because it was out of the landowner's control. That case involved Highway 100 getting closer to the landowner's property, and the government was arguing that the landowner could mitigate its damages through getting a variance. And the court ultimately held that the variance was too speculative, but it did not say that that variance was, as a matter of law, out of hand, a cure that was not available to the landowner. And obviously a variance is not in the direct control of a landowner. So I think there is case law on point in Minnesota about whether a landowner has to have direct control over the cure in order to have that be considered as a cost of cure.
You said the Paul case?
Yeah, the Paul case.
And is that cited in your brief? I'm not seeing it, but I might have missed it. Because there's more than one brief, so it could be missed.
Yeah, I don't have the page it's cited on.
But you believe it is? Okay, I'm sure you're right.
I believe it's referenced in there. Again, that's 95 Northwest 2nd 85.
Got it, thank you.
It's a 1959.
Counsel, if I may just follow up on this line of question, because I think this is sort of the key thing in here that supposedly made this case differ, right? Is the access, the ability of the landowner to just on her own to change the grade of the driveway. So is mitigation a necessary consideration in order for you to prevail on your appeal? You argue some mitigation. I don't see mitigation being determined at all by a fact finder in this case. I'm not sure how it was presented to a fact finder. It doesn't seem like something that we could decide a failure to mitigate or not on appeal. Talk to me about that.
Okay. No, I don't think mitigation of damage is necessary to be decided in this case. The county's case is simply that CBS failed to present evidence of damages for the taking that is in the condemnation petition. As I alluded to earlier, it represented evidence of damages for an 83,000 square foot temporary easement that is not in any petition order or jury instruction, and CBS used the incorrect measure of damages to determine damages in this case. It did not use the before and after method. It used a novel rental analysis. And the cost to cure verdict must be vacated because, as CBS's attorney said in the lower court, a cost to cure can only be applied where there is evidence of the difference in value before and after the taking. A cost to cure can only be applied where there's evidence of the difference in value before and after the taking. And here we don't have that diminution in value. CBS never presented.
So how would the case have proceeded appropriately in your view? So the appellant, the landowner, would put on evidence, expert testimony of what the land was worth before the change in the grade of the driveway and after, right?
That's correct.
And then let's say that they had never sought a permit. They just they had just never sought it. It wasn't their property to change. And so, you know, unlike other situations, perhaps, where they could change it themselves. So, and the county never offered it, or county never made the change for them, or refused to do it despite complaints or whatever. You're saying that, and let's say that it really did affect it. Can they not, what should they do? How does the case proceed? I mean, what's that issue then in that litigation? Like the reasonableness of the, it seems problematic that they could get nothing for a change, assuming it created a difference, let's say a diminution in value.
Yes, Your
Honor. Just because they're unable to cure it.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the burden of proof is on the landowner. That's in 117. And so the landowner would have to show the diminution value of the property before and after the interference with access. That's the Beer case. That's decades of Minnesota case law. And the fact that this was a temporary impairment of access doesn't change that analysis. As the Supreme Court in Elbert said, temporary takings are calculated using the before and after rule. So it's not like this is impossible to do, even if it is a temporary interference with access, which I don't agree with that. The taking is defined in the petition, and after the commissioners consider that, that's what the taking is. That's the Hilders case, that's the McAndrews case. The taking has to parallel what the commissioners have determined, because otherwise this whole process doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Right, I appreciate that part about the diminution of value. I'm talking about then, okay, but you're saying in order to even get that, you have to show the cost to cure.
Oh, no.
But I'm assuming a situation, right? I mean, if you don't show the cost of cure, I thought that was your argument, you don't get the cost.
Yeah, it's a prerequisite to, a landowner has to show the diminution in value before we even begin to start talking about a cost to cure. Because under Minnesota law, the damages are either the cost to cure or the diminution value, whichever is less. And so that comparison has to be made. And so because CBS did not make that prerequisite showing, that that threshold showing of a diminution value, by extension, it can't recover its cost to cure. This is the Salden case, where the landowner did not present a before and after, and the Minnesota Supreme Court in that case said there is no evidence to sustain the verdict, which was the cost to cure, the cost to raise that property, I think it was 3 feet, to the newly established road grade.
And you're saying the cost to cure, whether or not they had sought the permit or not, would have to have been put in there, even though it was not within their capacity on their own to cure it?
They would have to show that the cost to cure is reasonable, that it's not speculative, that they could obtain the permit, which I don't think is in any question here because CBS actually did get the permit. I'm not sure if that's answering your question, Your Honor. I'm simply saying that the before and after analysis has to occur before we reach the cost to cure, and that didn't happen in this case. So then, by extension, CBS cannot recover its cost to cure. So the verdict for interference with access is not supported by legally sufficient evidence, and because it represents damages for a taking that is not in the Third Amendment petition. Just to clarify, this taking is an interference with access, and that's how it's characterized in the petition and the jury instructions. And this.
So, counsel, you don't mind, I feel like you seem to be assuming something that I'm not tracking, which is that you define the taking in the Third Amended petition, but the bench trial on the taking happened before the Third Amended petition, correct?
That's true. So there's this mandamus action that happened ahead of time, and the court determines the nature and extent of the taking, and
that's a final decision because nobody appealed, right?
That's correct. That?
Yep.
And so the mandamus court is simply ordering the county to initiate a condemnation proceeding. And so we file a condemnation proceeding under Chapter 117, and it proceeds as if any other condemnation proceeding under that chapter. And so in this case, the county incorporated the order from the mandamus action or the relevant section of it into the petition, and that's how we got to where we are today. And the county amended the petition. Sometimes condemning authorities file a totally new petition, but we decided to amend the petition to incorporate this parcel. And so now this proceeding is on the same track as any other condemnation action. And if CBS wanted to object to the characterization of that taking in the petition, it had to do that at the time the petition was presented. Again, that's the Hilders and McAndrews cases. But in this case, the taking is a change in the elevation to the entrance of the property. And it is, the county did not close CBS's access. It did not put concrete blocks in front of CBS's access. It did not relocate the access. It did not remove access. There is a change in the slope of the driveway, and so some low-level cars will scrape when entering and exiting. But that's not the taking that CBS appraised. CBS did not present its case and present evidence of damages based on that taking. It presented evidence of damages on an assumed 83,000 square foot temporary easement. That is not in the petition or order or jury instruction. And because evidence of a temporary easement cannot support a verdict for interference with access, there's not legally sufficient evidence to sustain the verdict on interference with access. This case is very similar to Elbert. If you want to know what this case is about, this is about Elbert. This is about an attempt to undermine and subvert Elbert. Because if you recall, in the Elbert case, the Department of Transportation obtained a temporary easement that ran along the frontage of the owner's property. And there was a 50-foot deep section of that temporary easement that overlapped the driveway apron. And the appraiser in the Elbert case looked at that and said, well, the petition says a temporary easement, but a developer would see this and say, well, the government can come out here anytime it wants, perform any activity it wants, and further into the project, and fully use this area. It's really a taking of access. And the same thing is going on here. CBS's appraiser is doing the same thing that the appraiser did in the Elbert case, except the interests are different. In the Elbert case, it was a temporary easement that the appraiser alleged was actually a taking of access. Here we have an interference with access that CBS's appraiser is saying, actually, it's a temporary easement, an 83,000 square foot temporary easement that the county could not predict or foresee. Because as Judge Smith pointed out, there is no limitation, there is no outer limit on how long CBS could have extended this purported temporary easement. So this case is about Elbert. It's about trying to put in that sea change to eminent domain law that Elbert attempted to do. And so this court should follow the court in Elbert and say, no, the taking is defined in the petition. The taking was an interference with access. CBS did not present evidence of interference with access at trial, presented evidence of 83,000 square foot temporary easement, and therefore the verdict is not supported by legally sufficient evidence. The verdict for interference with access should also be vacated because it is not based on legally sufficient evidence and is contrary to law because CBS did not use the correct measure of damages. Minnesota law has been clear for decades that for an interference with access, the proper measure of damages is the before and after method, comparing the fair market value before and after the interference with access. But CBS put forth rental damages instead. And we know that that verdict for interference with access does not represent the jury's determination of what that diminution in value was as a result of the interference with access, because CBS's attorney never presented that evidence. He specifically testified he did not do a before and after analysis, and the county's appraiser found that there was no diminution in value as a result of this change in the grade to the entrance. So we know that the verdict represents these rental damages, and under Minnesota law, CBS is not legally entitled to rental damages for an interference with access. So awarding the rental damages is contrary to law, and as, again, the Salden case held, where there is no before and after analysis used, there is no evidence to sustain the verdict. As far as whether there is any evidence that there was a permit or that the property owner knew about the permit, Mr. Schopek testified that he has submitted more than a dozen permits. So clearly that evidence is in the record that this is not a secret. And I think that the before and after method can adequately address the taking of interference with access in this case. And so in conclusion, I would just like to say that I don't think this is a very complicated case. This case involves bedrock, pretty well-established principles of Minnesota law. And if we focus on Minnesota law and look at the Elbert case and the Salden case and the Beer case, I think the outcome in this case is quite clear. CBS is making this a very complicated case through alleging that this permit somehow changed the taking after the commissioners had heard it and after the court determined what the taking was, both in the mandamus case and in the Third Amendment petition. But if you look at Minnesota law, I think the outcome is clear and it's in favor of the county. Therefore, for the foregoing reasons, I respectfully request that the court grant the relief the county is seeking in this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, we have already reset the clock, 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel and I agree on one thing, and that's this isn't a complicated case. And I want to put it in the context, imagine if this was a tort case and a private party did this. Would I get just the rental value and or the cost to restore my property? No, you get both. You get the damages for the injury and you get consequential damages flowing therefrom. I think the further we go into our bags of legal knowledge here, the further we get from the correct result, because this is just a matter of common sense and fairness. We're just asking to be put exactly where we were had this taking never occurred. And if you look at
counsel,
the legal...
With respect to the cost to cure, I mean, it's quite clear in Minnesota law that the public doesn't have to pay more to cure than the difference in value from an impairment. I mean, you know, and you just simply don't have, you didn't offer testimony on what the market value was before and after the taking.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that presumes a permanent taking. If you look deeper into the eminent domain case law, you'll see that what cost to cure is just an alternative measure of severance damages. And we don't have severance damages here because no part of the parcel was severed from another part of the parcel. At the end of the taking, all of the property rights were returned to the property owner. So there is no cost to cure, as that term is traditionally used in eminent domain jurisprudence. What we have here is a cost of restoration. That might sound like a semantic difference, but it's not. Because if you look at eminent domain law around the country, the courts have unanimously, everyone that's addressed it that I found anyway, have said, when there's a temporary taking, what do you get? You get the rental value plus the cost of restoring it to its pre-taking condition. So cost to cure, as it is typically used in eminent domain law, just doesn't apply to the facts of these cases. It doesn't apply to temporary takings. And I want to address why you don't use the before and after. Cost to cure is just an alternative measure of the before and after, the lesser, if you will. The reason you don't use that method with this type of taking is because you can end up in a situation where the government takes property rights, private property rights, and the owner would get zero compensation. So this summer, CenterPoint Energy, they tore up my yard back to front. It was a mess all summer long. And then at the end of it, they replanted the grass and everything looked and redid the sidewalk and everything looked just as it did before. Now, assume they didn't have an easement to do that and that was a taking. What's the difference between the before and after of my house before they did that and after they did that? There's no difference. My house is worth the same as before and after. And that's why you don't use that type of analysis for a temporary taking, because I would get nothing in that situation. And do I deserve to get nothing when I had my yard torn up all summer long? Of course not. That's not fair. And what we're trying to do is be fair here. I want to address the Albert case for a second, because that's nothing like this case. What happened in that case is that the state filed a condemnation petition that said we're taking a temporary easement. It didn't say that we're also taking the access. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, well, if they intended to take access, they have to say they're taking access. And all they took there was a temporary easement. Contrast to this case, the condemnation petition does say they're taking access. So that case has nothing to do with this case. And by the way, in that case, when they said what the before and after rule applied to temporary takings, I don't even know why they said that respectfully, because they found that a taking had not even occurred, and therefore the issue of how to measure damages was not before that court at all. It was mere dicta, and I don't know why they included it in that opinion. Regarding mitigation, the burden of proof for mitigation, something that reduces the damages, that's on the county. Now, the property owner, yeah, we have to prove up what we think the damages are, but when it comes to things that reduce damages, that's on the county. And the county told the jury, or at least insinuated at trial, that my client could have got the permit sooner. Obviously, the jury did not believe that and awarded damages anyway. Regarding appraising this non-existent taking, I don't understand that argument because the jury was told what the takings were. So the issue at that point, once they were told accurately what the takings were, was whose evidence better measured how to compensate the property owner for that taking? And obviously the jury believed our witnesses. Nothing further.
Any questions from the panel? Judge Smith, anything from you?
No, thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case, particularly for the inconvenience given the evacuation and your return to the courtroom. We really appreciate that. Everything in this matter was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.